You're listening to Mr. Speaker Spotlight, the place to be recognized. On the internet at www.MrSpeakerSpotlight.com. I'm your host, Vincent T. Edwards, better known as Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker Spotlight shines a light on the positive in communities, companies, and organizations throughout the world so that people can be inspired and know that their dreams and goals can be achieved. This spotlight is brought to you by Where the Saints At. That's right, Where the Saints At. They are an e-communications company that can deliver your message dynamically and effectively. They deliver innovative e-campaign and e-promotion solutions to reach the faith-based audience. On the web at www.wherethesaintsat.com. That's WHEREDASAINTSAT.com. This spotlight shines on Carmen Cummings. She was the hometown face on the evening news in the North Florida region for more than 18 years. The former news anchor and reporter for CBS television affiliate WCTV has garnered more than 100 community service and professional awards, including those for the Associated Press, first place awards for her investigative reporting, feature projects, and individual achievement. Her accolades also include the Leon County Sickle Cell Foundation Humanitarian Award, the Jefferson County NAACP President's Award for Community Service, the Tallahassee branch of the NAACP Black Achievers Award, the Girl Scout Council's Women of Distinction of the Appalachian Big Bend, and the accolades go on and on and on. I just like to say that the veteran journalist that I'm going to interview today is the former district legislative representative and director of community relations for the office of U.S. Congressman Alan Boyd of Florida. She also worked in the press office of former governor Bob Graham back in 1983. Carmen is the founder of a women's ministry known as Heart to Heart. At her church, she also travels extensively to communities across the Southeast as a motivational speaker for youth and women's group. She is, and hopefully I'll say this right, a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated, an honors graduate of Florida A&M University. Carmen is the wife of Dexter T. Martin and proud mother of two young sons, Dexter Jr. and Nicholas. Welcome to the spotlight.
Thank you so much. I was hoping you'd stop.
I'm going to save some for the interview. And my first question is, I mean, with all of this investigative reporting that you've done, being in the news, what does it feel like to be on the other side now?
I don't like it. I never do like it because I'm used to being on the other side.
I know. Well, I'm going to make it as fun as
painless.
Possible. Painless. I may ask a few tough questions.
Okay.
But for my listening audience, if you had 3 minutes to tell the world who you are, the question is, what makes Carmen tick?
Well, in 3 minutes or less, I would say that I try each day in my walk to remain grounded. And when I say remain grounded, to the fact that I try so hard to be humble in my daily activities. That's why I was hoping you would stop. I was wondering when you asked me to send information what you were going to do with it. And I'm always hesitant because being a country girl from a very small community about 25 minutes southeast of Tallahassee, I spend a lot of time with my family, and especially around my grandmother. And my grandmother used to always say, never boast about yourself. Let other people talk about you. That way people can stand to be around you. And so I don't talk about myself and my accomplishments very much. I'm grateful to God for what He has afforded me and the different opportunities. But I think that's just a part of my persona that keeps me humble. And that's what I try to do. That's one of the aspects of my character that I think I'm most proud. I'm just a simple kind of girl, and it's the simple pleasures in life that do it for me. I'm very active in my church. I'm a musician for four choirs, involved in the dance ministry, and I have two young sons who are both active in church. My husband is involved in church. And so that's enough for me. And then I like being a wife and a mom. I was just thinking on Saturday, I was like, God, this feels so great to just be on the sofa. I think Florida was playing Tennessee on Saturday, and I was just curled up on the couch doing that. So I'd rather be at home over any event because I really am dedicated to being a mom. I think that is one of the most important honors that the good master can bestow on a woman, and that's an opportunity to be a mother. And so that's about me.
And I ditto that. I love it, you know, because I mean, people always ask me, "Were you a mother's boy?" Yes, indeed. I love my mama, and so there's nothing like the love of a mother. When you look at your career, when did you know you were going to enter the field of communications? Was there a love for journalism, communications at an early age?
It's really odd because I struggled, and I was telling a young lady, a young student, just the other day, how I used to struggle with self-esteem issues and as a kid. And part of it had to do with my environment. I wasn't from a large city. And for so many years, I used to be afraid and ashamed to tell people that I was from a small town. You know, the people would walk through the trails. You could hear the grandmas calling the kids in the afternoons. And all the kids knew that that one little yodel or whatever it was that the grannies would do, and you knew to come home. And I didn't have a lot of playmates. I did tomboyish things and playing plum trees and played marbles and things
played
like
marbles?
That. Oh, yes, I was pretty good, too.
You could shoot marbles.
I was a bad woman. And so, you know, I did things like that. In fact, I was such a tomboy that when I would get off the school bus in the afternoons and I would hop down with some of my cousins and we'd throw our books on the ground and we'd put that circle on the dirt road and get our marbles out, cat eyes and all. And I could hear my grandmother telling me to get up out of the dirt because my knees would be rusty and that wasn't cute for a girl to do. And so I played boyish sports because I didn't really have a whole lot of people to play with because when you're in the rural, everybody's kind of spread out. And so whenever we would go to visit relatives up north and they played ball in the streets in Philadelphia, they didn't have playgrounds or wide open spaces as I did in the country. And so some of my cousins would always say, "Tell them where you're from." And I'd always say, "Florida." And so they said that my cousins would say, no, that town, you know, that town near Tallahassee, you know, and I never wanted them to know that I was from Wasissa, Florida. And so where there was one post office and gas station / grocery store when I was growing up. Now we have two. And so, you know, it was just those kinds of things that I had to try to overcome. But my dad used to always tell me, "It's not where you're from, Carmen, but it's where you're going in this life and what you do to help somebody else once you've arrived." And so it wasn't until I was a teenager that I started to see the light of day and overcoming some of my shortcomings in terms of my confidence. And my parents made me participate in 4-H and another group called Future Homemakers of America. I don't even think they have FHA anymore. And so I was a part of the public speaking sequence. And I think my parents probably saw that I had potential, but I just couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. And so through those organizations, I learned how to speak in front of an audience, and I would participate in district competitions. And once I started to do that, I could say, well, it wasn't so bad. And so the guidance counselor in my high school said, "Have you ever thought about journalism?" Because I was active on the yearbook staff, and I'd help take pictures and do layouts and all that kind of stuff. And I said, "Well, no, I don't ever want to be in front of a TV camera." You know, that was the farthest thing from my mind. And so she talked to me about Florida A&M University. And so I came to FAMU, still didn't think I had a place. My first day on campus, All my classes were closed. I sat in the middle of the hallway and cried. And there was a journalism professor who took me in her office, gave me some Kleenex. She said, "Are you done?" She said, "'Cause we've got work to do.
Wow.
And you have a place, and I'm going to help you get there." And she's deceased now, and her name was Thelma Thurston Gorham, and she was a legend at the School of Journalism. And so I started as a print major and in the newspaper sequence because I discovered that I did like writing. I just didn't want to be in front of a camera. But my only problem was that whenever I'd write for the school newspaper, I'd always have trouble filling my quota in the columns. And I wanted to tell it and tell it quickly and get it over with.
Shorten to the point.
Right. And so I met the broadcast sequence division point person. And so he took me under his wing, and as they say, the rest is history. He submitted my name for an internship out at WCTV, and I did that and worked in the governor's office writing and doing some research for then-Governor Bob Graham. And I remember I thought when I heard some of the commentary that I'd researched, and he used that in a speech that he gave, and I thought, OMG! Oh, my gosh, I may be onto something here. Maybe I could be a writer or something like that. And that confirmation by Governor Graham that he had confidence in my writing and my ability really gave me a huge boost. And even though I did get the internship out at WCTV, I was hoping my college roommate would get it. She was from Bainbridge, Georgia, and I was pulling for her, never thinking that I would get it.
Wow.
And so anyway, it turned out that I did get the internship and worked at Channel 6 my senior year in college and had an opportunity to work part-time there on Sundays. And as a little church girl, you know, that was a difficult thing.
Yes, it was. But see, like me, I grew up, I was a preacher's kid.
So you understand.
But I took a job. Specifically because he asked me if I could work on Sundays. I was like, yes, so I could get out of church service. Mm. That's a whole nother story.
Well, you know what they say about PKs.
Yes, indeed.
But, I mean, you know, it was difficult. And for me, after I graduated and I didn't have a job, a full-time job, because I said if I was going to pursue this journalism thing, I wanted a full-time job. I graduated with honors, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm all that. Well, it didn't work out. Sometimes you graduate and you don't have the things that you anticipate.
Right. And totally so, different exactly, in the real world.
Exactly. So I had this one part-time job that wasn't enough to pay for college. And so I had to take on two other part-time jobs. And I took one job that I'm really most proud of, and I was a receptionist. And it was a humbling experience for me. And I thought, well, gosh, you went to school for 4 years, you graduated with honors, and you're a receptionist 5 days a week, and then you work on Sundays as a reporter. But it was a humbling thing because instead of being negative, I just decided I will be the best darn receptionist they've had. And it turned out that that was a really good thing for me because little did I know that when a full-time opportunity came about, that the people at WCTV went back and talked to the folks where I was a receptionist.
Because
you can put whatever you want to on paper pretty much.
Yes.
But when people start checking into your background, well, what's she really like and what's her personality? And a lot of the people that I dealt with in that job as a receptionist gave me glowing recommendations, and I didn't even realize it.
Wow.
So
you never know.
That was what helped me get in there full time. And that's why I have all the respect for people who are involved with customer service, because really, when, you know, you pick up the phone, you don't know how the day is for the other person on the other end, you know, and the way they can detect when you smile, even through the phone.
Oh, yes,
you
indeed.
Know, or if they can detect if you're grumpy and if you're not having a good day. But the way that you articulate and convey yourself in that conversation can make them have an even better day.
Yes, indeed. And for my listening audience, you know, small town, TV news, having to overcome those challenges like self-esteem, how were you able to really, really do it? I mean, what would you say to that young person, especially that young lady that's listening to this now? What can they do if they're experiencing the same types of issues?
Believe. You know, faith moves incredible mountains. And my faith had a lot to do with it. As a young woman who was embarking on the next chapter in her life, I had some experiences, but I had not had the experiences that I can talk about now. Mm-hmm. So I had a little bit of faith, but my parents had a whole lot.
Whole lot of faith.
And so they were doing a lot of praying for me and encouraging me. That's why it's so important to hang around major people and not minor gnats, I call them, you know, sources of aggravation. You know how gnats are, and you just can't, you keep fan, you know, they just hang around. They don't have anything positive to give you, just a source of aggravation. So you have to associate with people who are going to be genuinely happy when you have an accomplishment in your life. Somebody who can encourage you and say, Carmen, I know you can do this. I know I can see it. And so that's why my circle of friends then and now is very small, because I really do think that you will find, you know, I'd rather have a couple people that I know are genuine than have a room full who really don't care about longevity and success in my life. And people sometimes, I've had to learn, those are some hard, hard lessons. And so once I realized that maybe I can do this thing, and when I first started and I got this full-time opportunity, Sunday through Thursday, I still wasn't sure.
Wow.
I still wasn't sure because I was having to prove myself. And I remember once being at an event, and I overheard a woman say, and that was before a lot of people knew that I was going to be working there full time, because I hadn't told a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I had heard someone say that there probably never would be another black female there at the TV station.
Wow.
And so I remember standing in the corner of the room, and so I thought, I said, oh, well, I guess that's all she wrote for me. But then I said, you know what? You never know. I don't know what God has in store for me. And just because another person says it, you know, that person doesn't hold my fate. I know who does. And so I decided that maybe I wasn't going to let that statement, because I've never liked people to say what I can't do.
Yeah, don't tell me what I can't
do. Don't tell me what I can't do, especially when I know I'm a child of the good master. Okay, so I just decided just to give it a try and to prove the commentary wrong.
Prove it wrong.
Okay, so as it turned out, I started, once I had an idea of how to write for television, because it's not the easiest thing to do when you're writing for print, for newspaper and magazine. You write in a certain form that the reader can pretty much, using his or her imagination, see the story as they're reading your words. With television, it is my job to make the words complement the pictures. The pictures and the word, I write for what people see. And so it has to go together.
Wow.
So I was blessed in that I learned to do both. Write for television. I used to work for the Democrat as well, even while I was working at the TV station. I had a column in the newspaper as well. And so I got my big break when the gentleman that I had watched for many years, his name is Frank Ranicki, got a phone call that his wife was going into labor. And because my father had always told me, always know how to do more than one thing.
That's it.
I had no life. I was a young graduate, young worker, no boyfriend, no social life. So I was at the station late, learning how to use some new equipment. My shift was over, but there was some new editing equipment that had arrived, and I wanted to learn how to use that. So I was back there in the editing room working on the new equipment, and I could hear the fuss out there in the newsroom, and everybody was clapping, and, oh, my goodness, this is so wonderful. And then I heard somebody say, well, who's going to anchor the 11 o'clock show tonight? And so I just kept working because I knew they weren't talking about me. I hadn't been there long enough to, you know, have paid my dues the way some other people would have thought you should. And so someone came in the edit bay where I was, and it was the news director. And so he said, Carmen, he says, I know you've worked all day. He said, but everybody else is gone. We need you to do the show at 11. And I said, but I'm not a news anchor, and I don't want to be. I just want to be a reporter. That's all I want.
And you actually said that.
That's exactly what I said.
Wow.
And so he said, I don't care about that. We don't have time to deal with it. I will help you write the show. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And so he said, no, just get me through tonight, and I'll leave you alone. So I went and I called my mother, and I said, Mom, guess what? Here's the deal. Don't call any of your friends.
Because
I was like, please don't add pressure to me. I said, please don't call any of them and tell them I'm going to be on because I don't want to be thinking about that.
You shouldn't have made that phone call because you know Mama going to call everybody.
I needed her to pray for me, you see. I needed her to do that. And so anyway, she called all of her friends.
My and baby so, going to be on the news.
Yes. And so I got on the air and did the 11 o'clock show. It was on a Friday night.
That's a big night.
Yeah, football night.
Football.
High school football and all that, college previews. And so I had never done it before, so I didn't realize that when I said, and still to come, the weekend forecasts, we'll be right back. I didn't realize the camera was still going to be on me. So after I said that, I said, hallelujah. I sure did. And we were still on the air. And as they say, the rest is history. After that, I was promoted to weekend news anchor. And after that, I ended up being the 5:30 news anchor. And I had a little political type talk show where I'd interview different folks from the community. Then I went to 5:30 and 11. Then my big break finally came, and I got promoted to 6 and 11. And so it was, I had to sit there a couple times, you know, because you get so caught up in what you're supposed to do. And I remember one day I looked over at Frank, and it was right before the newscast started, and I thought, wow. You know, it was kind of like my whole life just kind of fast forwarded before me, and I realized for just a half a second, I'm sitting next to this man whom I've watched for years. You know, I'm not worthy. And I got really scared all of a sudden. I don't know why.
It's kind of like me. I mean, I've watched you on television, and now I have the opportunity to interview you here in the studio.
So I can understand.
I understand. You know, like at least, you know, we don't have to dress for radio like you have to on television.
Praise God. But, you know, it's just, and I think that's one of the things over the years, Vincent, it became more than just a job. I truly got very wrapped up into this job. It would start to bug me. Generally, every Monday, I used to end up in the courtroom somewhere covering first appearance hearings for incidents that would happen over the weekend. And I remember once, I knew that it was starting to get to me once I had gone to the Leon County Courthouse. And I'd gone under the garage to park, and I saw all of the inmates who had been arrested over the weekend, and they were filing into the door because they were being taken upstairs. And there was one of the littlest inmates with leg irons on. And then I realized, wow, this child is probably not much older or not much taller than my son. And I'd only had one child at the time. And I just sat there in the parking lot and I just boo-hooed. I had to really get myself together before I went upstairs for court because I realized that the system somehow, that we as a community or something had failed this child because he looked not more than 12, 10 or 12 at the time. And he was the littlest one in the group. And I thought, well, what could he have done to the magnitude that it would require that he was taken in the leg irons and the his hands cuffed as well. And it just, oh gosh. And so ever since, it would just really bother me when I would go, and whether it was Leon County or Gadsden County, and seeing grandparents standing before the judge, just bawling their eyes out, pleading for one more chance. You know, and when you've done enough of those, you know, I wouldn't get numb. And that was the problem for me. It would just be very traumatic. So I would go through a lot of emotions generally when I would have to go to court. And then I saw some very heinous crime scenes and covered a lot of hurricanes and
here in Florida.
Yeah, fell in ditches, you know, while I was out there, got stranded during some of the hurricanes. And so after many, many years of doing that and seeing all that I've seen, then we decided to have our second child. And as I was telling someone recently, I think it was during Tropical Storm Charlie, and I was expecting. I was 5 months pregnant then, and I slipped in a ditch while I was outside in the elements trying to cover this storm.
To give us the news we needed.
Yeah, and I kind of realized, wait a minute, something's wrong. I need to be home. You know, Mike McCall is telling everybody to stay home, and I'm out in this. And I kind of knew then that life was going to change because I just kind of felt like I didn't have the priorities together, that I really shouldn't have been out there at 5 months with this beautiful child growing inside me out there covering a hurricane. And so anyway, that was kind of the beginning for me. And then when we found out our son, after he was born, had sickle cell, and it was like the worst of the cases that you could have, it really made me think about my priorities for sure. And that was really the reason that I just left the way that I did, because I needed to have the time. I didn't need to be caught up on an island covering a hurricane if my son fell ill. I needed to be able to get to him and to take care of him for whatever length of time I needed. But I really struggled with it, Vincent, because after I'd done it for so long, it's very heartwarming to see children, especially in rural communities, and they would recognize me and they would identify with me because I was a woman of color, but also because they knew, a lot of them, that I was from a place just like they were. I could understand the social ills of many of the communities, because I had them all around me when I was growing up.
You were there. You've experienced them.
Right.
But yet you were able to overcome them.
And so, therefore, I felt an obligation to be there, because if they saw me, then they could say, you know, if she could do it, I can do it. And while I was there, right as I left, there was a young lady who ended up coming through. In fact, she interned just as I was about to leave. And her name is Lanitra Bennett.
Oh.
And she interned there, and she would talk to me about how she would watch me and all that. And now I have such a sense of pride when I see her. And there's so many others who've come along. Some of the students that I've taught as an adjunct at the university are now producers and anchors. And it's truly a blessing when you can be a blessing to someone else and have an imprint on their lives in some way.
It's all about helping people,
right,
and giving back. And that's what I really enjoy doing. And I love these types of interviews because they're heartwarming and they're inspiring and they're motivating. And it helps me to learn, wow, you know, there's something else I could be doing. There's something else I could be doing better. And I reach down. And I say, Lord, show me, what is it that I'm here to do? Throughout this entire interview, I've watched your nonverbals. There's a sense of connectivity here with regard to family. Family means so
everything
much to you. Yeah. And when you talked about your grandmother, there was just this light that just came across. Talk to me. How did your grandmother, what role did she play in your life?
Well, I wish she could have been around longer to play an even greater role. But she passed away when I was a teenager. But I'm grateful for the time that we had. My grandmother was a very simple woman as well, and she was a woman of great faith. And she only had a third grade education, but she was very wise. And she just had all these anecdotes that she would plant in my spirit just about life and choosing friends and making decisions wisely. And she lived in the house with us until she died. And she was a part of our lives. When I would come home from school, she was the first face I saw. And she would always, even on her dying prayer, was that she wanted God to bless the family, and she wanted God to let her baby be a star. And I often think about that, because I wish she could have seen that her prayer in a lot of ways was answered.
Was answered. Kind of reminds me of that hall of faith over in the book of Hebrews, that 11th chapter, when, you know, they had faith and all of them didn't live to see the promise fulfilled.
Right. That's right.
But they believed God. And I'm sure she believed God. And you are indeed a star. And that's why the spotlight is shining on you.
Well, I thank you for thinking that.
Today, let's talk a little bit about the musician in you. You sing, you play.
Yeah, that's why I've got that Bonnie Raitt thing going on, because we sang in church yesterday. Yesterday was youth choir day, and so I sing in the choir, and I have to sing a little harder because that's how you get the kids to because they're a little shy,
get them energized.
Gotta get them going. And so both my boys play the drums. And
great instrument.
I tell you. And so, you know, I do that. I mean, that's just been a part of my life. The choir's been a part of my life since I was 8 years old. And I've just been there. It's a little country church. A lot of people asked me, well, why have you never joined the larger church? And I'm like, well, why? You know, because I know that, of course, my pastor would be very sad if I left, but I enjoy.
And you can plug him. Who's your pastor?
My pastor. I was about to.
Go ahead. You can plug your pastor, your church. This is all about who you are.
Isaac Manning Jr., and he's a young pastor. In fact, my mother taught him. My mother taught him in kindergarten and first grade, and now her student is our pastor.
And which church?
So at Bethpage Missionary Baptist Church.
All right.
Out in the country. And we have some good church. Yeah, man. I tell you, I don't know any other way. But, you know, I think one of the reasons that I'm still hanging in there at the country church is that I'm always pushing those kids to go farther and encouraging their parents, you know, to let them go farther. The Bible does tell us to study, to show ourselves approved. In all our getting, we're supposed to get knowledge, you know, and wisdom. And so education, I think, is a great supplement. Education is a great supplement to faith. You know, put the two together, and I think you can really accomplish a lot. And at our church, I've just watched so many of our kids do great things. Some of them are on the FAMU High football team. And when they went to state, we were cheering them on. We have one of the kids who is also one of the drummers at the church goes over to Rickards. And we were all pitching in, helping him. He and the band went and played in the inaugural festivities when President Obama was elected. And so we were all excited that some people from our church were going to be a part of the inauguration festivities. We've got some folks my mother taught in grade school who now have their PhDs.
Wow.
And their principals and retired principals. And so there's so much that you can see. And we were just talking, I was just saying yesterday to the parents in the church that they have to speak positively over their kids. You know, I'm a big advocate of Jeremiah 29:11, you know, because he knows the plans that he has for us, plans for good and not for evil, for a future
unexpected
filled with hope.
That's it.
And so that's why I speak that over my children all the time. We pray about, you know, school in the mornings, that we can get that covering, you know, before they get out of the car. And so that's why I'm still at the little country church, because I see all the avenues of possibility. And so I'm trying to help those. I'm always a big advocate of the underdog, those who feel like they can't. I look at them and I think they can, because, you know, I've been there, done that.
You can. You can do that. You know, you should never despise small beginnings. I mean, God just does so much.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at where you grew up, that small area in Florida that you all said that's much that you just didn't want to tell anybody about. How did you make that transition, or what was the biggest transition, transitional challenge for you when you went from there to the highest of Seven Hills?
I knew that was coming. I knew, and that was a very difficult transition for me, because I wasn't surrounded by skyscrapers and subways and fancy malls and things like that. When I awoke every morning, it was to the St. Joe Paper Company pine trees. And that's all I saw. And it's taken till now that I'm a parent to appreciate that. And there's nothing like it. I love going home on the weekends to visit my mom, and I let the kids run around and play, and you see butterflies and all that. But when I was a freshman, it was a terrifying situation. Remember, I told you, I sat in the hallway and cried because I didn't think I belonged. You know, there were people from the big city, you know, Chicago, Philadelphia, and I could almost always tell whenever I met someone in my dorm. I used to live in McGuinn Hall on campus.
My God,
I used to call it Heartbreak Hotel.
My God, daughter's there now. Heartbreak Hotel. All right.
But, you know, I could just tell. I could tell from their accents. I could tell from their mannerisms that whether they were from Tallahassee or whether they were from a large city. And so I didn't have many friends, because I had to find my way. And I was speaking to a parent just the other day about that process, finding your way and being very careful about it, because you have to land in a place that you're comfortable. I could have tried to, you know, as they say, fake the funk, but, you know, I didn't want to do that, because, I mean, how long do you fake it before people realize, where'd you say you're from again? You're not really from Chicago, are you? You know, so I didn't quite fit in. And one day I was in the lobby on a Sunday, and I was talking to this young lady, and we were talking about a couple things. And I said, what'd you just say? I can't remember what we were talking about, sweet potatoes and something else. And I thought, well, wow. You know about that? And so, and it was almost like she looked at me, and I remember we just stood and we embraced, because we both knew that we were from small towns. And she ended up being from Bainbridge, Georgia, and we became bosom buddies. And so we were just kindred spirits. And so we hung out together, and It just meant a lot. And we'd always keep up with each other. If we'd met a new guy friend or something, then she'd have to check mine out and I'd have to check him out, you know. And then we'd always give each other the look, you know, if you're going out, there was just a way that we would look at each other when we didn't go out together. Most times we went together because it's always good, you know, at that time of your life to kind of hang out with someone that's a little sort of like your equal, because you just never know. Being a young woman,
yeah, college
just never
is a
know.
Whole new world.
Yes, it is. And so rarely were we without each other. But when we were, which wasn't often, she'd always give me that look and I'd do the same, you know, or we'd call or something, because at the time we didn't have cell phones.
Cell phones.
We'd have to call from the payphone. Hey, I'm over at so-and-so-and-so.
Payphone?
Yes, yes. It was 25 cents.
25 cents.
You know, I'm over at Howard Hall, or I'm going blah, blah, blah. We're going to get something to eat and we'll be back. And so, therefore, we knew there was that range of time that we could expect each other back. And so we were close until she ran off with the love of her life from high school. And he was a military man.
Oh.
And he took her off to Tulsa, Oklahoma. But that's where she remains now. And we still call each other to wish happy birthday and things like that. Yes.
That's one of the things I try to tell young people, you know, when you meet people. Just stay in touch. Mm-hmm. Always stay in touch. You never know. And with the onset of all these social networks like Facebook, I am running across all kinds of people that I went to high school with and that I've lost touch with over the years. And there's some great friendships, and it's just great to stay in touch. What brought you back to the Hill? So now you're there now. What
yes,
are you doing?
Yes, I'm the Director of Alumni Affairs for FAMU, for my alma mater. And as Dorothy said, there's no place like home. And so I always kind of felt in my spirit that I would be back there. You know, it's, I don't want to scare people, but I think that when you've had a journey that's filled with grace and a lot's mercy, and you just sort of become more in tune with your life. And when that happens, you get what's called, you acquire a great spirit of discernment about different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always sort of known that I can always tell when something major is about to happen in my life. There's just a feeling. I can't explain it.
I know exactly what you're talking about. God gives you like a sense of peace, but it's like it's not
right.
Like necessarily a troubling, but it's kind of like it's something.
Like something's gonna
happen. About
to
happen.
And so I've always had that, but I just started paying attention to it. And I remember once, this was years ago, that there was a guy at the TV station who told me that I was clairvoyant. That's what he called it. And so I just kind of looked at him like, you know,
okay,
good talking to you, bye. And so, but then as time went on, I just kind of started to watch different things. And, you know, you got to be careful what you pray for, and you've got to be careful what you speak into your spirit, because sometimes things will happen. So whenever, you know, you say, I know the plans you have for me, but whatever he does, it's going to be for your good. See, when you're trying to be in line with him and what he would have, then whatever you're going to do is going to end up being for my good. Sometimes we don't always understand it. And when we get to that struggle part, I equate that, since I know it, with birth. And you, as they call it, travailing.
Oh, travail.
And you have to, it's a painful thing for the baby to come into the world.
That process.
But when the baby comes, oh my gosh, it takes your breath away. So when I left WCTV, I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to go. But I knew in my spirit, because my son was in the hospital at the time, and I was still trying to do work over the phone. You know, I would see the nurses working on my son, and I kept thinking, you know, I really need to be paying attention to him, but I'm trying to do some work. And I remember one night, because when he goes in the hospital, I go in there and I stay in there until he comes out. And so I remember one night late, I was thinking that I really needed to get my priorities together. And I said a prayer. I said, you know, God, you said that you would provide all my needs. That means, you know, I need a job and I have to have gas in my car. And so I said, I'm just going to step out on faith and you're going to help me land because you know where my heart is, that I wanted to take it up a notch in being a mother. You know, I wanted to be there. And after disappointing my big son a couple times on some important events that were taking place in his life, and either I got there late or I missed them, I was in that struggle that I knew I needed to do something. And so I really do believe that Nicholas came along for a lot of reasons. One, because he's a blessing to other people, and we do a lot of charitable things because of where he is in his life to help other people. But he also came along because I needed to be more grounded. I needed to come down. You know, I needed to get that straight. And so after Nicholas got out of the hospital, I think it was in February 2002, I went back to work. And 2 weeks later, I tendered my resignation. And I was supposed to give them 30 days. I gave them 60 days notice so that they could find another person to take my place. And I wasn't really sure where I was going to go, but I had a feeling that everything was going to work out because I was praying based on what the scripture tells me. You supply all my needs. So I had to step out on that word.
Remind me of that old song. I've got a feeling everything is going to be all right.
And I had to believe that. I hadn't been tested like that before, but I just had to believe it. And so, sure enough, I was on an assignment for Channel 6 and had gone to a groundbreaking ceremony for a new emergency medical services unit in Greenville, Florida. Okay, that's east of Monticello and Wasissa. And so there was a gentleman who turned around. It was the congressman. And he had known my family for many, many years. He knew me since I was a child. And so he said, jokingly, when are you going to quit that job and get a real job? And I said, don't let me call your bluff. And so he looked at me. He said, are you serious? I said, what you got? And so, as they say, the rest is history. So I left and I went to work for Congressman Boyd, and I worked there until 2007. Well, one day I got a phone call, and there was a message that had been left for me from the president's office at Florida A&M. And so I said, oh, that's right. I did read that we have a new president at Florida A&M, and I was so proud because I remembered when Dr. Ammons was the provost at Florida A&M, and I had such respect for him and his work. And so I said, you know, I'll bet he's calling because he wants to set up an appointment with the congressman and talk about his appropriations budget for Florida A&M. So I started looking and trying to find a means to prep for it so I'd be ready when I returned the phone call.
That reporter in you. And
okay. So when I returned the phone call to Dr. Ammons' office, talked with his assistant, then she put me through to the president. And I congratulated him on coming home and just remembered the speech that he made to the Board of Trustees and how it just brought tears to my eyes when I heard the speech. And because I'd been in prayer that everything would work out for him as president. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, I know you probably want to have this meeting with the congressman about your budget and yada, yada, yada. I'm already working on it. And so he said, well, Ms. Cummings, he said, I thank you so much for looking into that for me. And so he said, and I probably will need that. But right now, I need you to come and be a part of my team.
Blew you away, didn't he?
Yes, he did. There was a long pregnant pause there for a long time. And so he said, are you there? And I said, yes, sir. I said, well, can I think about it? I said, I'm about to go on vacation with my boys. I was taking them to Typhoon Lagoon down in Orlando. And I said, give me some time, if you would, just to think about it and pray about it. And so, da-da-da-da.
The rest is history. You're back on the hill.
I'm back. Not as a student, but as an instrument to help more students gain the opportunity to be a part of the FAMU family.
Getting ready to ask you a tough question.
Okay. Bring it on.
Tough question. If I were to ask your husband to describe you in three words, take a deep sigh, what would he say? Because we often say, you know, we can, you know, just like with me, people see me all over the place and, you know, I on the radio and people have this image. But if you really want to know somebody,
ask the helpmeet.
What would he say?
He would say strong-willed, assertive, passionate.
What would your children say?
Well, if I could have added a couple more words, he would have said loving and compassionate as well. With my children, they would say no nonsense, loving, dedicated, because they know and they're understanding it because they felt the pressure of people asking them, why isn't your mommy on the TV anymore? Those who are old enough to remember. Mm-hmm. And they went through a lot of changes. It took a lot to make that decision. And they know that I gave up all of that for my kids. That's an incredible sacrifice to make. But Vincent, the thing is, when I look back at my career and everything that happened, I don't want to have any regrets. And the one thing that I want them to remember about me long, many years from now, when they are young men, or even when they were parent, when they become parents, I want them to remember the fact that mommy was there. That is something that money can't buy. That is the one thing that I remember about my folks. I was in the band. I was a majorette. And I remember so well, you know, my parents weren't, we were a family of modest means. That means basically I had the essentials. I didn't lack for food and shelter and things like that. I didn't have designer clothes because we just, you know, I knew about kids now. I can tell you about kids and Levi's, okay?
I feel you. Okay? I understand.
So, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. But the one thing I remember was when I would look up in the stands, Vincent, I would see that my father and mother had the same clothes on. I remember that now, that they had when we went to school that morning. And now, years later, as I reflect on that, my father was in the same clothes. He didn't have time to go home, freshen up, or anything. He came from work to see me and my 15 minutes of fame. That's what I remember, seeing them there for recitals and things that I was involved in. They were there. That is the one thing that I can say about my parents. All that other stuff, I'd rather have them there than whatever these designer things are that we see now, Tommy Hilfiger and all that. I'd rather have had my parents. And so that's the thing. You know, I know that it's important now. When we went to my son's last football game, I was late getting there because we were getting the little one and working on homework for him so that when we got there, we'd be at the game and we'd come back and only have homework to do for the big kid to help him. And so we got there and we were, I think, about 10 minutes late. And when we came in, I could just see he was on the field, but I could just see that helmet. And I know my child.
He was looking for mommy.
He was looking. And, you know, mommy, are you going to be there? And that's what they're going to remember, Vincent. It's not going to be, you know, that I had Nike shoes or whatever. They're going to remember being there. They're going to remember the times that we've all been in bed together, tickling each other. They're going to remember story time. They're going to remember being there, rounds of applause for the speech that was said at the assembly program. Those are the things that they're going to remember. And for me, Vincent, that was worth the sacrifice. Being there because, and it really hit home. I remember I was doing the anchoring thing, and my son asked me if I was going to be at his chorus concert. He was 7 years old, and I told him, yes, yes, I'll be there. Are you going to be there, Mommy? All the other parents are going to be there. And I remember we said goodnight, and right as I was about to walk out the door, a murder had taken place in Gadsden County. And then it was, Carmen, can you just make these couple calls for me? And I remember I looked at the clock, and it was 6:40. Carmen, you're getting a return phone call from the sheriff's department. Then it was 6:45. Then it was 10 till 7. And so I got on the road, and I did a terrible thing. I sped like a bat to the school. And when I got to the school, all of the parents were walking toward the exit. And then as the crowd thinned, I could see my son standing there. And he didn't have to say anything. But my son, knowing the way he is, I walked up to him, and I'm up there trying to explain the grown-up thing to a seven-year-old. But, honey, I had this, and I was trying to, and all he said to me was, but, Mommy, you promised. And I'm telling you, man, that was like a dagger. I remember that. My big son is 14 years old, but I have never forgotten that. And even till this day, he will ask me, Mommy, you going to be there? And I've missed one football game, and that was because our younger son, Nicholas, was in the hospital. And it was his first football game, and I really struggled with that, but I needed to be there because Nicholas was having a transfusion done and some other things. But my husband was there. I thank God for him because he's really been just, as the old folks say, a leaning post.
Leaning post.
Okay. So we lean on each other, and I generally take the kids to school. He generally picks them up. And we work well together in taking care of them and being there. And for my husband, this is a big deal to him. The parenting thing is a big deal to him because he lost his father when he was a young man. And I have lost my father as well. So we've got these two groovy grandmas, you know, who play ball with the kids. They've had to be Papa and Grandma.
Wow.
And they come to the games, and, you know, those are the only two parents that we have now. And so I tell my kids all the time that time is precious, and so we do a lot of things together. We celebrate birthdays. We go on family trips together with the grannies, and for Father's Day, we take the grandmas out, you know, because they're Grandpa and Grandma.
That is this.
And so that's how we're trying to teach. And I've always told the boys that family means everything. You never treat people, even if they're your friends, outside your home better than you treat the people within your home. Because when all else fails, family is what you should have. That's the core of it all.
That is it. And, you know, that whole concept of time and spending time. I often, when I'm out speaking and I have a group of adults and I ask them the question, if there was one thing looking back on your childhood that you could have from your parents, what would that one thing be? And 9 times out of 10 is if I could have had more time with them. Wow. You just, the stories you've shared just almost brought tears to my eyes.
I was struggling because, you know, I'm a barrel of water. It is very difficult.
I'm sitting over here trying to hold it.
It's very difficult. But I'm, Vincent, it is so, you know, and it might not be the ideal scenario for every parent. Every parent may not be able to stop and then transition because I had to just pray my way. I used to work. I know about shifts. I used to work 2:30 to midnight, and I had to really pray and make that prayer investment because I just knew that I wanted to avail myself. It's one thing when it's not that big a deal to you, but when it's a big deal to you, then and you know the kind of parent that you're trying to be, like you said, there's no dollar value on that. And so I had to just pray that God would work it out so that I could be in place for my children. And I'm grateful that he did. You know, it did I give up a lot? I did. But I don't regret it. If my boys, and I tell them this, if they choose another direction, I want to have a clear conscience. I don't want it to be because I did this, Mom, because you were never there or you were always working and you would never blah, blah, blah. You know, because there are times that they want, for example, my youngest son loves to draw. And then sometimes he'll just come up, you know, and he'll want to, Mommy, see, look at this. And what do you think? Or, you know, he'll want, kids have all this kind of energy, man.
All it the time. Stops. I have a 9-year-old. It's like.
So, you know.
Yes. And he's an only child.
Oh,
so he doesn't
bless
have.
You.
Ooh, yes.
Yes. And so he wants daddy to play and they feel like you should have time. And sometimes it's not what they say, but it's the look on their face. And it makes it look like you don't have time. And so you have to sometimes rearrange things to just say, okay, I can't do it right now, but let me finish this, and then I'm all yours. Or you pick a show, and we'll watch that together. Before I got it straight, Vincent, I heard somebody talking one day about SpongeBob SquarePants. And Vincent, I didn't know what they were talking about. I was like, what's that? Because I didn't get a chance to watch television. And so that was before we had the second child. And then I remember I heard a parent say, you don't know about SpongeBob SquarePants? And I'm like, wait a minute. You know, so I sat down one night. My son at the time was 5, our firstborn. And I watched SpongeBob SquarePants. Because I'm like, well, this is something he's watching.
I need to know what it is.
Okay. And you know, now I know all these things. And we read stories together. And we laugh. And, you know, and there are times, even though my big son now is starting to get a few hairs on his lip and he's taller than I am. Vincent, I can't tell you what it means. Sometimes, you know, we're palling around and he'll just lean over. He'll look at me, Mom, I love you. And it's like, whew, gotta take a moment, you know? Yes. And I remember in the grocery store Saturday, and I said to Nicholas, I said, you didn't give me sweet sugar today. And so he comes over and he kisses me. And he wasn't whispering. He just said, Mommy, I just love you. And you know, we're at the point now where we're going, when we go to the grocery store, Saturday, my task was to show my son things to buy because in 4 years, he's going to be graduating high school. And I want him to learn about selecting groceries and what mommy buys. And then, you know, we're moving into the cooking thing. I've taught him how to iron and my husband has worked on different things, you know, the boy things. And so we're at that stage now, but I've still got this little one, thank God, who still climbs up in my lap, you know.
And cherish those moments.
Ooh, man. Wow. It's awesome.
I just, you know, this interview is just truly blessing me, this strong sense of family and dedication and what it's all about with regard to being a mother. And it's this whole concept of balance, because education is key. And there's so many opportunities out there today for women and to be successful. But at the sense of your core is what I'm feeling, that out of all of this, when it's all said and done, I want to have been for it to be said that
That's
I
it.
Was a mom.
That's it.
I was the best mother that could ever could
That's
be.
It.
I was on television. I've done this. I have. But I want my boys to know
That's
that mama
it.
Was there.
That's it.
And it touches me because, you know, I lost my mom a little 2 years ago. to breast cancer. And, you know, dad's going to be a dad, but mama was always there.
Yeah.
And I tell anybody, love your mother, because when mama gone,
that's it.
Dad is going to be there, but when mama gone, because there's always, I always joke about it. I say, you know, you could want something, and you go to daddy, and daddy say, no, it ain't happening. You know,
yes.
My grandma may not be correct, but it ain't happening.
That's it.
But you go to mama, and you whisper, and mama go talk to daddy, and you ain't privileged to that conversation. You don't know, but somehow it all changes, and you get what you want. Because mama has a way getting from daddy.
You know, it's just, and you have to know the right time to talk about it. And we're dealing with those kinds of things. And mom, the big one, you know, mom, dad just, mom, help me. And I'm like, just let it go. I'll talk to you later. Let me talk to him. But mom, he's going to forget. Just let me deal with it. And if there is, it's just interesting because your species is different, you know, and so are we. Now, the way to rock the house is to make mommy mad.
Oh, don't.
is to make mommy mad. When you don't want peace in the house, you just make mommy mad.
I'm going to go way off on a tangent here to all those men that are out there listening to this.
Oh, keep mommy happy.
Happy wife, happy life.
Happy home.
Happy home. Because when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
That's pretty much accurate.
The pets. Not even the pets are happy. And yeah, I'm going to, I mean, I could just go on and on, but I know time is limited. I'm going to give you just the space of however long you want to summarize who you are, what you're about, and what would you say to that person that's listening now about being inspired, accomplishing your dreams? And I'll do it like this. You have 2 minutes on stage, graduating class of high school students. What would you say to them so that they'll remember what you said, why you said it, and 30 years from now, they'll say, I am where I am because Carmen said this.
Wow. Well, if I were on stage to a graduating class of high school seniors, I would tell them to resist the fear of turning the knob on the door to opportunities, to reaffirm their faith, because that gives them the strength to move forward in pursuit of their dreams. That's the foundation. When you can believe, see, a lot of times we sit on the benches or we sit on the chairs, and we don't often look before we sit. That's because it's faith, right? And so that's the same analogy that's applicable to our lives. Once you've got the foundation, then you can move forward. And to be patient in the pursuit, to prepare for the dream. You can have a dream, but if you're not doing anything to prepare yourself for it, then that's like going into the kitchen with a desire to cook, but not having the right utensils to make the meal. And once you've prepared yourself, then you're ready for the pursuit. Patience is very important. And when I think of those graduating seniors, I look at them as I would cocoons. It takes time, but eventually when the cocoon is shed, there's a butterfly that comes out. And then the butterfly goes into the world to find his or her place. And that's an exciting thing because you've been waiting for so long to come out of the shell. But you do that. And once you start flying and once you start finding your place, and once you're pursuing your dreams and the dreams are coming true, don't forget the word humility. Again, humility makes it possible for people to be around you. Humility can open greater doors than you can imagine. Arrogance is a major roadblock in success. It can be, especially when you are aspiring to be someone. Once you've gotten to the pinnacle, and once you've decided, I want to be a family man, or I want to be a wife or a mother, don't get so caught up in the hustle and bustle of life that life and success and cars and money overshadow the being that God has placed in your life. It is so special to be chosen to be a parent. And when you're given this gift that doesn't ask to come into the world, it's just that, a gift. And with all the knowledge and preparation and patience and aspirations and success in your life, you have an opportunity to take all of that and mold this little being that you've been given. That's a mini me. It's a mini you. And so you want the mini me or the mini you who's going to go through the same process. And when his cocoon opens, have you ever noticed on the butterfly, sometimes there are different imprints and dots and designs.
Yes, indeed.
All of those, that's our imprint. That's a little piece of you that's going out into the world. It's called the circle of life from Lion King.
I've seen that movie lots of
times. Okay, so that's all a part of it.
Lion King.
And with each life that is given to you as a gift, you have an opportunity to make an imprint. See, that's one thing I like about pencils. I like using pencils because I tell people all the time that my grandmother and my mother, you know, may not have been on Time Magazine or National Geographic or USA Today or whatever, but they're part of the history. They're on the cover of my life because of the things that they put into the seeds that they implanted in my life. And so those things that have been passed down from Hester Woodson and Naomi Cummings and now to me are things that I'm sharing and putting seeds into, and Bill Cummings, into my sons, you see. And so that chain isn't broken of values and worth is not broken. And that's what's important to me. And that's what makes life count. And I always say, if somebody shows up when the time comes to my service or memorial, fine. But I'm trying to live it each day so that if you don't say anything, people will know. Time, family, faith, all of those things were the foundation of Carmen Cummings.
The works that I've done.
Speak.
For me. Carmen, thank you for being in the spotlight. You have truly just touched my life in this short time.
Thank
so
you.
Many things that I've just picked up and I've mm-hmm. gleaned from this conversation. And you've made me a better man by your stories today. You hit some points home. You nailed them. I mean, you just nailed them. I mean, this whole sense of family, the whole sense of being there.
You can't get it back.
You can't get it back.
Mm-mm.
Because my son plays football now, and, you know, I wasn't feeling the best this weekend. And he said, Dad, are you going to be at my game? And I looked at him, I said, Isaiah, you my big man. I'm going to be there. And it just means so much to them because, you know, my father wasn't there at my stuff. But I made it a point.
And you know what? Isn't that interesting? That you're probably maybe in your 30s now.
Oh, thank you so very much. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. But
I always take the high road, man.
I ain't no shame in my game. I'm 43. I'll be 44 in December.
Amen. But the thing is, when you look back, what you just said is what comes to mind. And when I talk to my husband, you know, and that was something. You know, he learned, it's interesting. I learned how a man is supposed to treat a woman by the way my father treated my mother. And so that is why it is important for men, especially African-American fathers, to do what they're supposed to do. You know, you want to be more than just a sperm donor.
That's it.
You know, these little boys need their dads. And so that's why I've had many conversations with my husband, and I've watched him struggle with a lot of different issues relative to that. You know, just not having a father there, you know, seeing his mother do all that she did to raise he and his sister. And just how he would say, well, I'm learning a lot. I'm doing things based on what I wish I had had. And so because of that, you know, when I look at him, when I see that he wants to do one thing or another and want to do it at school, or, okay, I'll go, I'll do that. No, that's okay. No, I want to do it. You know, I'm going to go and talk to the coach, and I want to make sure that he has what he needs for this game, or, you know, does he need to study, or does he need to do? And I watch that, and I just see the kind of father that he is, and I'm grateful. And I see that in you.
It is, you know, because, you know, mama was always there. Dad was there, you know, but we didn't have that relationship. Mm-hmm. And now that we're older and he and I talk and everything, and I tell him what I'm doing, he says, that's good, son. That's good. You're spending time.
But you know what? I think, Vincent, I think a lot of the scenarios that we go through as a people with men is that for so many years, a lot of our strong fathers wanted so much to just make sure the family had what it had, and the mother would do the nurturing. And because maybe when they were coming up, their fathers did the same thing. Some of them worked on the railroad. Some of them went away and worked and sent the money home. A lot of them, I heard a man say on television the other day that he's loving to his son because his father never hugged him and told him that he loved him. And I can't even imagine that, but that's what he recalled as a grown man who is now a father. He remembered, and I could see in his face that even as a grown man, there was just that little hurt for just a minute that he said, my father never hugged me. I don't recall my father telling me often that he loved me.
And neither do I. And, you know, and for, you know, Isaiah, I mean, he'll come in the room and hop in the bed and he'll say, Dad, you know, you're the world's best dad.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Dad, I love you. And he'll give me a kiss on the cheek. And I'll give him a hug. And it's just almost just
I'm telling you.
Your composure. And it's just like, and that's the thing. And I don't recall my dad. And wow. He may have. I just don't recall.
You don't have vivid memories of it.
Vivid memories of it at all. I can remember one time when my dad actually picked me up and held me. And that was because I got hit by a bicycle. I mean, we were playing basketball and a bicycle came by and it hit me, and I couldn't walk back because my leg got caught in the spokes of the bike when it hit me. And as the only time I could really remember my father embracing me, because he picked me up in his arms and he carried me back to where we were living in the house. It's about the only time I could ever and remember. And then when I was ordained, my ordination ceremony, he was there when they put my collar on. And, you know, he hugged me, and I could feel the love there. But, you know, and I'm 43 years old, but it's all these times. But now it's like, it's so commonplace. I talk to my son all the time. Son, I love you. I'm here for you. But I don't recall my dad doing that.
Wow.
And it's so important, because I talk to young men, and I've talked to them and incarcerated, and they say, you know, if my dad was there, right. if someone, another man would have. And so I understand the importance.
And that's why it's so important to have strong men of color in our community who are trying to make a difference, because there's so many people, there's so many little ones, you know, who are going to find themselves in a posture where they may be raising themselves and will never know that. There, I really do think that God has a special place. There is a special calling for men and for fathers. We can't, and I know that this is traditional. I know this is very traditional.
Go ahead.
But we cannot forget that you were made first. So there was a call on your life from, as they say, the get-go. Okay? So, and we came along because we have a place. There's obviously a definite place because we came from your side.
And you're supposed to be right there with us to help us.
Okay? So I just think that it is such a tragic thing that we're seeing now. So that's why when I have an opportunity to talk to men or to talk to women, it is so easy to get caught up in this hustle. I'm telling you, it can just swallow you, and then you realize.
And you look up.
You know, when you look up and you say, well, I'm putting a roof over your head. I'm making sure you have shoes on your feet, and I'm giving you a packed lunch every day or lunch money and blah, 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 blah. But the kid, you know, I thank you for that, but I'd rather have you there.
Dad, what are we going to do fun today?
Yes. Can you read me a story?
That is the what are we going to do
Can
fun today?
Can you watch with me? Or can we play ball outside? And those are the things that they're going to remember, just as you do, just as what I remember was having the essentials, but I remember love in my home, my father. I remember the first time I got my heart broken by a boy, for real.
For real, for real.
I'm telling you. And I remember putting my hand on my father's shoulder. And he was stroking my face, and he said, you know what? You're going to come across another one, and you may come across another one. And then he said, I thought you said I was your Prince Charming anyway. And that's what he would say to make me laugh.
Wow.
And then I just remember that. I remember that. And, you know, I miss him terribly. But, you know, I'm thankful that I at least have my mother, and we're close. We talk every day, sometimes 4 or 5 times a day, because I want to make sure she's okay. And I talk to my mother-in-law. I want to make sure she's all right. And so these are the queens of our family, and that's how we treat them. And so and get the boys to understand, you know, they're little, but they will remember all of these times.
They will. And I'm definitely going to remember this spotlight. Thank you so very much, Carmen.
And thank you for your time. You were able to delve into some places.
Wow. You've been listening to Mr. Speaker's Spotlight on the web at www.mrspeakerspotlight. Just want to let you know, remember, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And Mr. Speaker says, whenever you speak, speak life. Be good, be blessed, but most of all, be a blessing to someone. This spotlight was brought to you by Where the Saints At. Where the Saints At is an e-communications company that can deliver your message dynamically and effectively. They deliver innovative e-campaign and e-promotion solutions to reach the faith-based audience. On the web at www.wheredasaintsat.com. That's WHEREDASAINTSAT.com.